listening to Harris Smith Radio. I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. In this episode, we go all in on planting, planting gardens at our gyms, therapy, and workplaces that don't take a lot of work, and planting that attracts pollinators, our little at-risk insect pals that do all the heavy lifting when plants want to have sex with a middleman in between. By the way, if you want to read Harris Smith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harris Smith Radio. Elizabeth Pierce is an award-winning author, a mom, and an avid and frugal gardener in Halifax, Nova Scotia. In her new book, Grow Hope, she brings a fresh take on starting a garden from scratch, kitchen scraps, and ingenuity. She sees gardens as gyms, workplaces, and classrooms, and also as a place to toss your banana peels and bicycle box cardboard. Here's our conversation. Hey, Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed your book, and I really liked the fresh take you took on what gardens are. You talk about gardens being schools and workplaces at the beginning of the book. And what do you mean by that? How are you seeing gardens?
Well, I've always found my own garden to be a school and a workplace for me. I started out when I was very small, and I call it my lifelong apprenticeship. My grandparents took me into their garden and taught me everything that they knew. They were farming folks from the Annapolis Valley in Nova Scotia. And so I learned an awful lot about biology, plants, insects, vegetables, cooking, preserving. There was so much that I learned in the garden, more than I ever learned in school, to be honest. So I call it my school, but also it feels like a workplace, the best possible workplace, because it's outdoors and it can be collegial. You can garden with other people. I garden with my family and friends. For me, it's been just the most wonderful place of learning and of what I call honest labor.
I like that approach because it could be very appealing to somebody who is a first-time gardener, or as you point out in the book, somebody who's tried it before but thought, oh, this is way too complicated, or I'm having too many failures, or the bugs are eating everything. So I like that you're giving people hope that this time, if you try gardening this way, it might work for you.
I wanted to convey to people, even people who have gardened for a few seasons, that just because there have been failures in the past doesn't mean that it's anything that you're doing or that it necessarily will happen in the future. I've talked to many gardeners in my life, and I would include myself in this group, who every year we learn something new. It's always a learning experience, and there are sometimes some seasons are better for some crops than others. You know, you might have a fabulous tomato year one year, and then the next year it could be awful. So, and you might not ever know why. I find it's kind of a humbling experience in that sense, but it's also there's great potential for expanding one's knowledge.
Let's start about knowledge, because you've really given people a ton of knowledge about how to start gardening. And in an earlier podcast in the season, we talked about some tips about starting early. And you've got some great advice in terms of starting plants indoors in pretty sensible ways. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I'm doing it right now, actually. I'm sitting next to my grow light in my kitchen in Halifax. And right now I'm growing bok choy and onions and leeks and all the early, what I call the, you know, early birds that you can start indoors at the end of February, beginning of March, because they don't mind the cold. They will go out probably later in May. And there are other plants that probably, like tomatoes and eggplants and squash and so on, that should be started maybe later on in March, depending on where you live. But it gives us an opportunity when it's still cold and still very Canadian winterish out there to get our hands dirty and get gardening and yet not have to contend with the elements. So starting indoors, I think, is really fun. And it's a great thing to do with kids. I have a 10-year-old son, and he helps me. We gather the materials, we make our own potting soil, we have recycled coffee cups out there, and we make little peat pots out of newspaper and toilet paper rolls sometimes. it becomes kind of a craft project as well. So it engages us on many levels.
I like how you're engaging your children and also that you're using like toilet rolls and stuff, that it's very, your book is very practical and very frugal in terms of what you need and what you don't need in order to start.
Thank you for saying that. I'm a frugal person and it's a quality that I appreciate in others as well. And yes, it's true. You don't need to spend a ton of money to get going with gardening. A lot of the things that I talk about in the book are very DIY. There's a section where I talk about making your own compost, which I think you do too. You were saying earlier, and you and I know it's like not that difficult. I mean, you're probably finer at it than I am, but you know, nature takes care of most of these processes, and it's just for us humans to kind of just help it along.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to talk about compost some more in a minute because you and I have a very different approach, and I actually like mm-hmm. your approach better. So mm-hmm. let's talk about some limitations that people might face in terms of starting a garden. You have a limitation in Nova Scotia and a lot of other places in Canada that it's not exactly the tropics, right? But other people have limitations in terms of, say, yard size. And you talk about, and I love the description of lasagna or sheet planting. Can you talk a little bit about how you make use of a yard using the lasagna method?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, you want to check with your housemates to make sure that they're okay with giving up part of the lawn, because what you're going to be doing is killing grass, but you're doing it not in a backbreaking way. You're doing it by just covering it up with, first of all, with cardboard or newsprint, and then piling other organic material on top. So around here, we're lucky to have many beautiful shade trees on my street and in my neighborhood. And we often gather in the fall, we gather big bags of dead leaves after they get raked up, and our own and other people's, and we bring them into the yard. And if I know someone who's wanting to start a lasagna bed, often we do it in the fall. So we'll start with, you know, the cardboard, which you can pull out of a dumpster if you're near one. I like to go to the bike shop because they have the nice big cardboard, but you can go to the liquor store anywhere and just break it down, pile it up. Then you add some leaves. This is like the brown, what I call carbons. So it's basically compost is a mixture of carbon and nitrogen, browns and greens. So the greens would be like the wilted lettuce that you left too long in your fridge, or cut grass that you may rake up and want to pile on top of the leaves. But you're basically creating layers, just like if you were making a lasagna in your kitchen. It's made of layers. So you go from brown to green, and then you always end with a top layer of browns or a covering. So just so, not just for aesthetic reasons, your neighbors might not like to see banana peels lying around your yard, but unless you have really cool neighbors. But you're creating by covering it up on top. You're just sort of protecting the decomposition process, and nature really does take care of it after that. So it's pretty simple, and incredibly, it was an incredible relief to me to realize I didn't have to get out there and start, you know, digging up sod when I started my garden. I could just literally start by adding cardboard and go from there.
So you're actually doing this right on top of an existing lawn. You're not digging, as you said, you're not digging the sod out. You're not going 6 inches into the earth. You're just starting, here's my lawn, here's my cardboard.
Yeah, exactly. And what happens is the grass under the cardboard eventually dies, and you'll be piling soil on top of soil. But basically, eventually, after a couple of years, when the roots of the grass have died, the plants will be able to burrow into that existing lawn, former lawn, and access the nutrients that are there. I would caution city folks, city dwellers, if you're living particularly in an older city, like here in Halifax, you know, there's been European habitation here since the 1750s, and we haven't been exactly a clean bunch of people, right? We dumped a lot of toxic materials sometimes in our own backyard, including the ash and the clinkers out of the coal furnaces that we had. And so some yards have problems with arsenic or lead. Lead is a very common culprit, especially near buildings that it may have had. Old buildings had lead paint that peeled off and ended up in the soil, and it's very immobile. It won't move once it's in the soil. So you might want to do I always recommend for people starting out, it's a good idea to do a soil test in the area where you want to garden. And that's where you can dig around a little bit in your lawn, just with a spade, and just get it tested at a lab, just to make sure there's no nasties in there, heavy metals and the like.
So this is a method that I think could really appeal to older gardeners, right, that are maybe afraid to or can't actually do the digging that's required and can't get down on their knees as easily, right?
You know, this wasn't my idea, the lasagna gardening. It came, I think that one of the first mentions I heard of it was a wonderful book in the 1970s called The No Work Garden Book. And it was by an octogenarian from Connecticut whose name was Ruth Stout. I don't know if you've ever heard of Ruth Stout. She's maybe not as widely known now, but it was one of the Rodale series of books that were so popular. And my grandmother had this book on her shelf and I got reading it one day and I really liked Ruth's approach because she didn't call it lasagna gardening. She called it sheet composting. That's its other name. And that's all she did basically was, as she said, I throw my trash out onto the lawn and it becomes my garden. And it was incredibly easy. And, you know, this woman was in her 80s and she had these fantastic award-winning gardens. I mean, she kind of downplayed, she wasn't actually throwing stuff right out on the lawn, but she was composting in sheets and she created incredible soil and incredible plants by doing it. So yeah, absolutely. It's a cool method.
Now, if for folks who don't want to take that approach, you also suggest that you can do container gardening. And, you know, to sort of use a paraphrase another phrase, you know, everything's a container if you're brave enough, right? That you sort of advocate using things like plastic milk crates that students use for shelving and stuff. So talk a little bit about, again, from a frugal point of view, what can people do or what can people use to container garden?
Well, you hit my favorite one right off there, the milk crate. And the reason I like it is drainage. And this is the most important thing with any container is drainage. So you know how a milk crate has all the slats in it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it's a good idea. You're going to be putting soil in there and it will sift through the holes. They're big holes. So I always use a piece of burlap or even cardboard again, just at the bottom, just to make sure it doesn't all spill out onto my step or wherever. If you don't like the aesthetics of a milk crate, though, there's lots of other options. Like I had a friend who had a balcony garden in downtown Halifax. She didn't have a lot of room, but man, was she able to cram a lot of vegetables in. She went over to the European delicatessen and got these large feta cheese containers. It was food grade plastic, which is kind of important, I think, for food gardening. And she drilled holes in the bottom, drainage again, right? And it had these cheese containers had plastic handles so you could pick them up and move them around, which she did when it got windy or cold. She'd just bring them into her living room temporarily if it was a frost coming. And the nice thing about them was they were kind of square, almost square shaped. And so she could line them up and maximize the space. Yeah, I mean, old ice cream containers, the big kind, you know, at the ice cream parlor, they'll give them away for free often. They come with lids and they're good for compost. Some people use them for composting as well. Make sure, though, of course, to drill holes in the bottom because the drainage is so important. If you don't do that, then the rain won't be able to get out anywhere and you'll drown your poor plants. So I always tell people, whatever you use, just drill a hole.
So we talked about being very efficient with the container gardening and stacking things to get the maximum growth from the smallest amount of space. You also are a real advocate for, you know, sort of square foot gardening. For folks who aren't familiar with that idea, let's talk about it again, because again, it goes back to your frugality, in this case, the frugality of space and sort of in some ways, the messiness of planting that releases the potential of a space to give up as much produce as possible, right?
Again, this is a bit of an aesthetic choice for some people, whether or not to do square foot gardening, because with that, you're going to use, as it implies, every possible square inch. I know we're in Canada, I should say square meter gardening, but so you're going to use it all. There's not going to be any of those rows like you see on the cover of the seed catalog. You know, it's not that style because the space where you walk in between the row is basically wasted space in the square foot philosophy, right? So you want to create a bed where you can actually move around without stepping on plants, but you're basically filling up your whole bed with whatever it is you want to plant.
Now, another approach to space is the idea that I think you got from a municipal gardener, a guy named David McLern, right? That was saying, look, let's mix food crops and show crops, sort of, you know, flowers and stuff. And he said, you know, let's plant some like golden beets or rainbow chard. Let's talk a little about that, because that's a really interesting idea.
I think it's brilliant because for one thing, I think there's a belief that vegetables can't be ornamental. Flowers and vegetables have to be kept separate. And, you know, I don't know, you can't put vegetables in your flower bed. And I don't know where that idea came from originally, but I think vegetables are intrinsically beautiful and ornamental, you know, and also edible. They serve many purposes. They're colorful in many cases. They attract beneficial insects. And the companion planting aspect of having flowers and veggies together is really fantastic because flowers will attract more pollinators, more bees and wasps that will help pollinate things that really need it, like the squash and cukes and everything else. So yeah, I'm a big fan of all of that. And I think people are starting to see the possibilities more now.
No, that's a really cool idea. So I want to move on to composting, because I was saying before we started recording that my wife and I are, and we have a compost sieve, and we try to make really nice looking loamy compost to spread on the earth. And you're taking a different approach. You were talking before about the woman that inspired you in terms of the lasagna gardening, not throwing real garbage out onto her lawn, but your compost approach seems closer to that than it is to making soft loamy soil, right?
Well, I admire you a lot, Wayne, you and your partner, because, you know, man, sometimes I wish my soil looked like that, but you know, I'm a busy working mom, you know, with a child who's, you know, been at home a fair bit this year, and I just feel like, oh man, I wish I had the time to sift. But yeah, I like a good challenge with compost. Like, I feel like I want to see how long it takes to compost different items. So I've even put, I will admit to you here that I once put my old Birkenstock sandals in the compost just to see how long it would take for the leather and the cork to break down. It was kind of an interesting experiment.
And how did that experiment go?
You know, it chewed it up. It took a couple of years. I had to, you know, dig it under a couple of times, and it left behind the metal buckles and the sole part, which was, I don't know if it was plastic or rubber, I think, but yeah, it works. You know, stuff will eventually. I've put things like my wool mitts when they wore out, I tossed those into the compost and they disappeared after a year. So compost is such a miraculous, amazing activity that happens everywhere. And I love the idea of bringing that transformational power into my garden. And I compost a lot of things. I have two big bins that stay covered most of the year just because we don't want, you know, animals getting in. We're lucky to have municipal composting in Halifax. So I put the really, you know, the stinky items and the meaty bits and the bacon grease or whatever go into the green municipal bin. But right, all the rest is mine. And I really value it because it's an absolutely no cost way of creating beautiful, beautiful soil, as you know.
So let's talk about garden pests. And I can tell that you are a mom and you worked on this book with your son or daughter, because the pests that you have in the garden are Dr. Tweezerbutt and slime monster. So let's talk about insect pests.
Sure. I had to make light of a problem that otherwise could become quite depressing. You know, there's nothing worse than going out into your garden and, you know, the night before you had a beautiful patch of lettuce and then you come out in the morning and it's been completely chewed or mowed down by some horrible insect. But, you know, it's a reality that we all have to deal with. And it's a bit like life, right? You have to just go with it. I am a big proponent of organic, non-chemical treatments, if possible. If you have a serious infestation of something that's really making your garden's life miserable, then you may have to upgrade to a pesticide, you know, a non-organic pesticide. But as much as possible, I try to go the low impact route. And I have to tell you that I think I talked about this in the book. When I was a very young child, my first job was actually hand picking slugs and potato beetles off my grandparents' garden. And I got like a penny a beetle or a penny a slug. So I was very motivated because I was quite entrepreneurial. And I had a little can of soapy water or salty water, depending. And I used to drown them. And then I'd bring the corpses in and they would be counted out and I'd be given my allowance. So, you know, hand picking sounds pretty vile, but it's actually the most effective way to control some of the slow moving guys. I wouldn't say it works for things like the striped cucumber beetle, which flies away as soon as it sees you. So you have to get a little more crafty with those guys. But a lot of the times, you know, hand picking is the way to go.
Well, I really like the idea of you like getting a Bazooka Joe bubblegum package for five slugs. That would have been, at least when I was in Nova Scotia, that's what you could have bought, right?
I remember that. I used to save those wrappers so I could get my
comics
prize. Yeah, I was very motivated.
So let's talk about weeds. There's another kind of pest in the garden. And I was really interested in one of your recommendation was to eat it. And purslane is one of the ones that you mentioned, which is a sort of a ground cover that just spiders out all across. And I hate it. And we just pull it up. But you suggest eat it.
Well, you know, I never would have thought that because, like you, I spent a lot of my gardening days pulling this weed out, and it was really noxious. And then I was looking at a seed catalog from the U.S. It was one of these fancy ones, you know, for sort of a high-end clientele, I think. And they were actually selling purslane seed. I mean, it looks good, but who would have thought of eating it? And then I was like, well, if you can't beat it, eat it, right? So, and of course, I had a history of eating. My granddad taught me all about lamb's quarters, which are really beautiful. Their other name is wild spinach. And they do taste exactly like spinach. You can pick them. They grow pretty much from mid-July on. And when they're small, they have a beautiful, delicate flavor. And I love to steam them and eat them with butter. And I've also loved dandelion greens for a long time as sort of a early spring tonic that has wonderful properties for our liver.
So we spent a lot of time in this interview talking about the practicality of gardens. I just want to end with just your thoughts on when you talk about reimagining your garden. You wrote that you want to feast your senses on the earth. Look, touch, smell. Okay, maybe don't eat. And you say, I listen to the soil after a heavy rain has ended and swear I can hear a slurping sound. So let's end with sort of your sense philosophically about what the garden means to you.
Oh my gosh. The garden for me is a very, very much alive, a very living, breathing, slurping being. It's a bit like my mother. I feel very, very connected in a very profound way. Both my body and my spirit are very much connected to the act of tending the earth and tending the garden. I like to witness the growth. It, for me, it's a metaphor for change, for constant, you know, fruitful change, just watching it from its beginnings in the spring through to the fall and just the incredible flourishing and, you know, the harvest and how I can teach my son that, yes, you can do this too, that we don't need to be dependent on a big food system. We can grow it ourselves. There's just something so satisfying in all ways about it, both from the senses and I think from the spirit.
That was Elizabeth Pierce from her kitchen in Halifax, not far from that slurping thing, her garden. Pollinator Partnership Canada is a nonprofit that aims to protect and promote pollinators and their ecosystems through conservation, education, and research. I had a chance to talk with the organization's director, Vicky Wojcik, about our pollinator pals, and there are hundreds of different kinds, as you'll hear. I want to talk about pollinators because I think a lot of people think of pollinators and think of honeybees in particular, but there are like 800 kinds of bees in Canada, native bees in Canada, and there's other pollinators. Can you talk about the depth and breadth of pollinators in Canada?
Oh, absolutely. It is such a diverse group of species. So a pollinator is really any animal that visits a flower and moves its pollen. Of course, honeybees are the most famous ones, and they're really, really important in commercial agriculture because they're easy to manage. They live in a hive in a nice box, and you can move that box where you need to for crop pollination. But in the natural world, all of our meadows and forests and the various ecosystems, there's just this huge diversity of bees. Like you mentioned, more than 800 species in Canada. There's butterflies, moths, flies, even mosquitoes that pollinate plants. So all of these insects visit plants. And in Canada, we also have some vertebrate pollinators, hummingbirds. These species will go drink nectar at a plant, move around from plant to plant, and they get covered in pollen. They move the pollen, and then the plants get pollinated. So it's a really sophisticated relationship, and it's really, really rich in form and function.
They make up about 90% of the pollination that happens with plants, right?
The majority of plants, they can't have their pollen moved any other way except for an animal. About 90% of plants need a pollinator to move their pollen. The other 10%, like grasses and some of the pine trees out there, they use wind. So they produce a lot of pollen, the wind blows and their pollen moves on its own. But it's very fair to say that essentially all plants, 90%, need a pollinator to move that pollen and help them reproduce.
So we're experiencing a lot of, and we have done for decades, urban sprawl. And we're also seeing concern about monarch populations, although they were really good this last year, it seems anyway. And certainly honeybees with neonicotinoids and other threats to honeybees. So what can the average average person do in their backyard or in their community to help pollinators out?
One of the best things that you can do is plant diverse habitat. So you basically just said it there. The big threat to pollinators is a loss of their habitat. So as we grow cities and we grow agriculture and we change the landscape from what it used to be to something different, we've actually removed that habitat for pollinators. But it's not a one-way street. There's a great solution to it. So when you now are sitting in your garden, you have the opportunity to put back a diverse mix of native wildflowers that'll help feed those pollinators. Then there's a couple more steps too, of course. So please plant habitat, plant a lot of it. And also make sure that that habitat is healthy for pollinators. So in your garden, don't use pesticides. They're really not necessary for the home gardener. If you have a diverse garden, you're going to have a great mix of beneficial insects that are there that will deal with any pest species that you have. And we can all tolerate a little bit of perhaps insect damage on leaves if the benefit is to the pollinators that are there, that they have great, good, clean food sources.
And there's benefit to the people who actually do it, right? Because if you plant milkweed, say for monarchs or other plants for other pollinators, you actually get really good results, right?
Oh, you absolutely do. So this is what's great about this concept of planting for pollinators. You put a plant in the garden. It's designed to have a pollinator visit it because it's a local native plant, and a pollinator comes and visits it. So you get exactly what you're looking for. You plant a milkweed plant, you'll get monarch butterflies visiting it. You'll get the caterpillars on the plant. They'll grow into adult monarch butterflies, and the cycle continues. You have this great opportunity to have a thriving habitat.
Well, thanks very much for sharing information about pollinators and about the circle of life for pollinators and for people who like pollinators and help pollinators out. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
That was Vicky Wojcik of Pollinator Partnership Canada, a friend to dusty insect pals everywhere. So here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast at Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast player. And please tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on newsstands of selected stores across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.